or maintaining information on United States persons solely for the purpose of monitoring activities protected by the First Amendment or the lawful exercise of other rights secured by the Constitution or laws of the United States. As the Republican nominee for president, Trump was lawfully exercising a fundamental right guaranteed under Article 2 of the Constitution, running for office. Nearly every aspect of his campaign was also protected by the First Amendment's Free Speech Clause. Any attempt by government agents to abridge those rights was a violation of the law, as noted above. Therefore, the FBI's investigation of Trump, a candidate for president, should have been undertaken only upon a reasonable and good faith showing that a crime might have been or could be committed and based on reliable, articulable facts upon which the Bureau became aware. In the absence of credible allegations or information that a specific law was broken, the probe was unlawful. Periodically, the FBI sought to justify its investigation by claiming it was a counterintelligence probe to gather only information about illicit Russian activities and not a criminal case requiring the Bureau to first ascertain a potential crime. This was a subterfuge to hide the true purpose, which was a criminal investigation of Trump and his campaign. As McCarthy explained, it may be called a counterintelligence investigation, but the objective is to undermine Trump, not Russia. This became evident when Comey appeared before the House Intelligence Committee on March 20, 2017, and delivered the following carefully prepared statement defining the FBI's objective. "I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as a part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election, and that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. As with any counterintelligence investigation, this will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed." The last sentence is the operative one. Comey appears to admit that the FBI's counterintelligence investigation was, in fact, a search for criminal activity involving the Trump campaign. But the FBI is only allowed to open such a probe if it has first identified something that might constitute a crime. Former Special Assistant U.S. Attorney Fred Tesi believes that the FBI launched an investigation in search of a crime against Trump in violation of the law. "I have yet to see any evidence of a crime. The way it is supposed to work is that the FBI comes to the U.S. Attorney and says, 'We believe that this crime is being committed and here are the reasons why.' There must first be some evidence of criminal activity. It is not enough to say, 'We think these guys are doing something nefarious, so let's go investigate them.' It's even more troubling in this instance because they used this kind of counterintelligence, which gives them a little more leeway to start an investigation of U.S. citizens. That's an absolute outrage." So, again, what crimes are we talking about? And what facts did the FBI have in its possession when it decided to investigate Trump over alleged collaboration with the Russians during the campaign? The immutable truth is that there were no crimes and no culpable facts from any credible sources. Collusion is not a crime. The word collusion became a prominent part of the American lexicon the moment word leaked out that the FBI was investigating Russia's interference in the presidential election and whether anyone in the Trump campaign was involved. Although the FBI initiated its probe in July 2016, the Bureau kept it hidden from public notice for months. Still, the word collusion began to creep into the national conversation when outgoing Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat from Nevada, sent a letter to FBI Director James Comey on August 27, 2016. In what was obviously an attempt to influence the election, Reid made his correspondence public, surely hoping it would damage Trump. A key paragraph contained an incendiary claim. "The evidence of a direct connection between the Russian government and Donald Trump's presidential campaign continues to mount and has led Michael Morell, the former acting Central Intelligence Director, to call Trump an unwitting agent of Russia and the Kremlin." Without citing any evidence, Reid had accused Trump of being a Russian agent. He further implied that the Republican nominee's campaign was involved in the cyber theft of emails hacked from Democrats' computer systems. He demanded that Comey investigate, although Reid probably already knew there was a Trump-Russia investigation. His goal was to find a way to make it public. What precisely prompted Reid's inflammatory accusations? He would not say, but it was later reported that 2 days before Reid's letter, he had received a visit from CIA Director John Brennan, who told the minority leader that the Russians were backing Trump. Brennan, a well-known partisan who had served in the Obama White House, had every interest in seeing Clinton succeed his boss. The fact that Reid did not mention Brennan, but instead cited his predecessor, suggests a clever decision to hide the true source. Documents later obtained by Congress revealed that Brennan's visit to Reid was intended to damage Trump's candidacy and was sanctioned by the White House. Representative Mark Meadows, Republican from North Carolina, later discovered the documents in his work on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. It appears there was a coordination between the White House, CIA, and FBI at the outset of this investigation, and it's troubling. Text messages between the FBI's Peter Sturzok and Lisa Page reportedly corroborated the coordination between the agencies and the Obama administration to target Trump. Indeed, one text message dated August 5, 2016 states, "The White House is running this," an apparent reference to the FBI's Trump-Russia collusion investigation. Comey, of course, had already opened an investigation into the Trump campaign. Brennan and Reid likely knew this, but were searching for a way to make the matter public before the election. Reid's leaked letter to Comey served the desired purpose. It was picked up by news organizations. Notable was the Washington Post's story, which characterized the accusations against the Trump campaign as collusion. This seemed to have been the genesis of a term that was laden with criminal overtones. The story, however, gained little traction beyond the initial reporting. So 10 days before the election, with the outcome in doubt, Reid fired off another letter to Comey with the goal of contaminating Trump with the same unfounded accusation. "In my communications with you and other top officials in the national security community, it has become clear that you possess explosive information about close ties and coordination between Donald Trump, his top advisors, and the Russian government, a foreign interest openly hostile to the United States, which Trump praises at every opportunity." This time, several news organizations ran with the story. The Washington Post called it a brazen claim, even for a man known for bare-knuckle politics. But the newspaper once again described Reid's claim against Trump with the invidious term collusion. With that, the word seemed to take on a life all its own. Over the next year and beyond, it would be misused and misunderstood in a deliberate effort to falsely accuse Trump of crimes he did not commit. The media, which never bothered to examine the legal meaning of collusion, embraced it as their cudgel to bludgeon Trump in the press and on the airwaves. Reid, of course, had a notable history of spreading a lie to damage a Republican candidate for president. In the 2012 campaign, he took to the Senate floor and declared that GOP nominee Mitt Romney had paid no taxes over the past 10 years. Reid had no evidence to substantiate his claim. He made some vague reference to an anonymous source. In all likelihood, he simply made it up. It was a completely false accusation. Romney's tax returns showed he had, in fact, paid millions of dollars in taxes. Reid's depiction earned him 4 Pinocchios from Fact Checker, while PolitiFact slapped him with the infamous Pants on Fire award. Reid was unrepentant and later seemed to brag about how his spurious allegations may have cost Romney valuable votes. As for the Trump-Russia collusion, the Office of Director of National Intelligence had found no evidence of any such activity when it made its public declassified ICA report on January 6, 2016, just before the new president's inauguration. That same day, in a private meeting, Comey assured Trump he was not personally under investigation. The FBI director later confirmed this when he testified before Congress in June. "Prior to the January 6th meeting, I discussed with the FBI's leadership team whether I should be prepared to assure President-elect Trump that we were not investigating him personally. That was true. We did not have an open counterintelligence case on him." While Comey and the FBI had found no evidence that Trump committed any wrongdoing or had otherwise collaborated with Russia, the agency maintained its investigation into whether members of the Trump campaign, other than the candidate himself, had colluded with Russia. Comey first acknowledged this publicly in March 2016, during his appearance before the House Intelligence Committee. The revelation that Comey and the FBI continued to pursue collusion even after the Bureau had participated in the larger and far more encompassing ICA probe, which found no evidence of it, raised serious suspicions that the Bureau was chasing a criminal case against Trump for political reasons. These suspicions were reinforced in a March 30th conversation when Comey refused Trump's repeated requests that the director simply reveal the truth to the American people. The president was not under investigation for collusion with the Russians. Lost amid all of the speculation about collusion was the fundamental fact that no such crime even exists anywhere in American law as it pertains to political campaigns. Comey had tasked his agents with finding a crime that wasn't a crime at all. It was, at its core, a legal impossibility. The FBI could engage in all manner of spectacular jurisprudential gymnastics, but it would never change the fact that colluding with Russia was not, by itself, a violation of any provision in America's criminal codes. Maybe it should be a crime. Perhaps these events will prompt Congress to consider criminalizing such conduct in political campaigns someday in the future. But other than monetary prohibitions on campaign contributions, there is not a single statute outlawing collaboration with a foreign government in a U.S. presidential election, or any election for that matter. Why then were so many people who followed the Trump-Russia saga under the mistaken impression that collusion is a crime? Principally, it's because the word is loaded with an historically criminal connotation. Collusion became a prominent part of the legal vocabulary when Benjamin Harrison occupied the White House and Congress passed the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, outlawing collusion in some business practices. Specifically, price fixing and other anti-competitive activities became a criminal offense under Sections 1 and 2 of the Act. Almost overnight, the word collusion was converted into a legal pejorative. However, collusion is only criminal in an antitrust setting. It has nothing whatsoever to do with elections. That did not stop politicians, pundits, and journalists from either misunderstanding the concept and or misconstruing its application to the Trump-Russia hysteria that reached a deafening pitch. When I first wrote a column arguing that collusion was not a crime in the context of an election, some in the media turned to law professors to try to disprove the argument. While the academics all seemed to concede that collusion applies strictly to antitrust matters, they suggested that other statutes with different names might have been violated if the Trump campaign was conspiring with Russians. Of course, a person can conspire to commit a crime, but what crime? One professor suggested a fraud statute that makes it a crime to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services would be applicable. This, he claimed, would include fixing a fraudulent election, which, of course, is redundant. It is true that such a fraud statute exists, and in the abstract, under certain specific circumstances, it might be germane to some other case. But it bears no resemblance to any of the facts or claims in the Trump-Russia case. This was made clear in Skilling v. United States when the Supreme Court ruled that the Honest Services Law only covers bribes or kickbacks schemes. No one has ever asserted this ever occurred in the investigation of Trump and his campaign, nor is there any evidence of it. So the referenced fraud statute does not apply, not even close. Another professor pointed to campaign laws that prohibit foreign nationals from donating money or other thing of value in a U.S. election. But again, neither facts nor accusations in the FBI's investigation of Trump support a violation of law on this basis. No one has suggested that the Russians contributed money to the Trump campaign. Even if information was conveyed, it is not considered a thing of value under election laws. This will be explored in greater detail later in the book in a discussion of the infamous Trump Tower meeting involving the president's son. Still another professor referred to a general anti-coercion federal election law as a possibility. But this statute is not pertinent either, because it forbids acts that intimidate, threaten, command, or coerce a government employee involved in political activities and elections. How does that remotely apply to the Trump-Russia case? It does not. What about the hacking of emails in the accounts of the Democratic National Committee and an associate in the Clinton campaign? To be sure, such conduct is a crime under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as another professor insisted. Indeed, if the Trump campaign conspired to work with the Russians to accomplish this, it would be a conspiracy crime under the Act. But there was never any evidence this occurred. It therefore had no relevance. It is true that during the campaign, Trump once quipped that the Russians should try to locate the 30,000 emails Clinton destroyed. But a facetious public jibe hardly qualifies as a secret conspiracy. Verbal encouragement to locate missing documents is not enough under the law. Normally, it would require an overt act or agreement to assist in the commission of the crime. It appears that no one outside of the U.S. government, including the Trump campaign, even knew about Russia's hacking efforts until well after they were accomplished and made public 2 days before the candidate's remark. The elusive nature of collusion did not, however, deter the intensive search for incriminating evidence of coordination between the Russians and Trump or his campaign. Various congressional committees and other agencies spent months scouring records, documents, and written communications. Countless people were interviewed. After a 9-month investigation, the Senate Intelligence Committee revealed that it had conducted in excess of 100 interviews over 250 hours, held 11 open hearings, produced more than 4,000 pages of transcripts, and had reviewed some 100,000 pages. Every intelligence official who drafted the ICA report on Russian election meddling was interviewed, as were all relevant Obama administration officials. Every Trump campaign official the committee wanted to hear from was interviewed. What did the committee find? Nothing to speak of. Literally. The bipartisan leaders would only say, "The committee continues to look into all evidence to see if there was any hint of collusion." The next day, the chairman, Richard Burr, criticized the sensationalized media coverage when he said, "We will find that quite a few news organizations ran stories that were not factual." It is unlikely Burr's committee had uncovered evidence of Trump-Russia collaboration. He said as much when he informed reporters in his home state. To date, there has been no evidence of collusion. His co-chair, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, agreed. When asked on CNN whether there is any evidence of collusion, he responded, "There is a lot of smoke. We have no smoking gun at this point." In the months leading up to the Senate committee's update, others with access to the various investigations were equally candid. Leading Democrats like Dianne Feinstein of California and Joe Manchin of West Virginia confirmed they had seen no evidence of Trump-Russia collaboration. Both sit on the Intelligence Committee. If such evidence existed, they would certainly know about it. In addition to the Senate investigation, the House Intelligence Committee conducted its own probe, examining some 300,000 documents and interviewing roughly 70 witnesses. In early February 2018, its chairman, Devin Nunes, announced there is no evidence of collusion. A month later, his committee's majority issued a report announcing the same conclusion. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Adam Schiff, who had spent more than a year condemning Trump for colluding with the Russians, claimed it still remains to be seen, but he could offer no evidence after spending months searching in vain. During that time, he had described the evidence as ample and damning. However, 2 weeks after the committee's report became public, he seemed to concede during a televised interview that there was no proof that Trump or his campaign ever colluded with the Russians to influence the presidential election. Representative Trey Gowdy, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, which conducted its investigation, also confirmed there was no evidence of collusion. The results of these probes put a lie to the repeated statements of Democrats who had consistently condemned Trump in numerous public statements in the preceding months. Senator Harry Reid, a master of false accusation and smears, said the Trump campaign was involved in Russia's hacking of election emails and stated unequivocally, "There is collusion there, clearly." He offered no proof. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was forced to resign as chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee amid her own scandal, said that contacts between people associated with the Trump campaign and Russians reeks of collusion. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, known for her inflammatory and overwrought statements, promised she could guarantee that Trump was in collusion with the Russians to undermine our democracy, although she offered nothing in the way of evidence. Neither Wasserman, Schultz, nor Waters ever produced a scrap of evidence to support their fallacious claims. Not to be left out, Hillary Clinton implied that Trump colluded with the Russians to influence the campaign against her by guiding the hacking of Democratic emails. Her comment was delivered while promoting her book explaining why everyone else caused her to lose the presidential election. The mainstream media was equally complicit in shaping a misleading and often fictitious narrative that the Trump campaign committed a multitude of crimes by collaborating with Russia. Reports by ABC, CNN, and NBC cited acts of collusion, but were later retracted or corrected when they turned out to be false. The intelligence community knew there was scant evidence of any wrongdoing and, when pressed, was forced to admit it. James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, twice confirmed that he had seen no evidence of collusion. As the basis for his conclusion, he cited reports from the National Security Agency, the FBI, and the Central Intelligence Agency. James Comey, when asked if Clapper's assessment was correct, stated, "I think he's right." John Brennan, the former director of the CIA, testified that he didn't know about alleged collusion, an improbable claim. But he conceded, "We see contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons all the time." Brennan's predecessor, Michael Morell, who twice served as acting director of the CIA but remained well connected to the intelligence community, was less cagey and coy when he said this. "On the question of the Trump campaign conspiring with the Russians here, there is smoke, but there is no fire at all. There's no little campfire, there's no little candle, there's no spark, and there's a lot of people looking for it." The statements by Clapper, Brennan, and Morell are compelling since they were senior Obama administration intelligence officials. As such, they were privy to all of the information gathered by both the FBI and the alphabet soup of intel agencies that were investigating the matter. And of course, Comey headed the FBI itself, which launched the formal Trump-Russia probe. He had access to all of the evidence, or lack thereof. There are two reasons why the multiple investigations have, to date, failed to produce any evidence of criminal collusion. First, it is not a cognizable crime under any statute. Other ancillary crimes, as pointed out, have no relevance or application to anything that occurred during the campaign. Second, there are no facts to support this amorphous notion of collusion. The First Amendment protects the right of Americans to speak freely to and associate with any person. Russians are no exception. Candidates are allowed to meet, greet, and exchange ideas or information with foreign nations during political campaigns. There was never any evidence that candidate Trump had personal conversations or contacts with Russian government officials or anyone connected with the Kremlin. Indeed, he consistently denied it, and no one has come forth to assert that he did. His frustration over being falsely accused of colluding with a foreign power during his campaign was understandable. It is why he asked Comey and others to reveal the truth that no evidence existed that would prove otherwise. People who are wrongfully persecuted feel compelled to try to clear themselves of the taint of impropriety. It is the natural instinct in us all. Trump had the same right as a private citizen or public figure or presidential candidate. Talking with a Russian is not a crime. During the course of the 2016 presidential campaign, associates of the Trump campaign had occasion to meet with or talk to Russians. Some of the encounters were quite brief. None of them constituted criminal activity by Trump or his campaign, nor did they present a substantial, articulable, factual basis for an investigation by the FBI as the law demands. Why? Because it is not a crime to talk with a Russian. There is no statute in the U.S. criminal codes that makes it illegal to have a conversation with or even receive information from a Russian. As Americans, we are free to travel to just about any country in the world, including Russia. More than 200,000 visit there each year. Ideas and information are routinely exchanged without criminal implications. We are allowed to engage in business enterprises with Russians. More than 1,000 U.S. companies, large and small, do business in Russia. Ford, Boeing, Pfizer, PepsiCo, McDonald's, General Motors, ExxonMobil, Procter & Gamble, General Electric, and just about every major American company have operations there. Hundreds of Western firms have representatives living and working in Moscow and St. Petersburg. In 2016, Russia was the 38th largest export market for the United States and the 24th largest exporter of goods to America. Our own government does business with Russia, selling more than $100 billion in bonds. In essence, millions of Americans collaborate, or, if you must, collude with Russians every single day. It is not criminal to do so. It is not unusual for U.S. political candidates to try to burnish their foreign policy credentials in advance of an election by traveling abroad and meeting with foreign leaders. Ahead of the 2008 presidential election, then-Senator Barack Obama was criticized for his lack of experience in international affairs. So he visited Iraq, Afghanistan, Jordan, Israel, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, meeting with leaders there. While in Germany, Obama met with Chancellor Angela Merkel and Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier in a discussion about future American-German relations. No one ever accused Obama of colluding with the Germans. He could have traveled to Russia and met with Putin. It would have been perfectly acceptable and legal. Many other candidates in modern electoral politics have done much the same. Some of them engaged in aggressive actions that would make Trump campaign contacts seem tame by comparison. Senator George McGovern, as the Democratic nominee for president in 1972, attempted to negotiate with the leaders of communist North Vietnam over the issue of prisoners of war. Senator Edward Kennedy allegedly reached out to the Soviet Union on behalf of Democrats in advance of the 1984 election. Merely traveling to Russia or meeting with a Russian government official on American soil is not by itself a violation of any law. These contacts, assuming that any of them were even in the possession of the FBI when the Trump probe began in July 2016, were not sufficient to meet the legal requirement of a substantial factual predication in the FBI guidelines. There were also at least 18 contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia in the months before the presidential election via emails and telephone calls. But according to a Reuters report, the people who described the contacts said they had seen no evidence of wrongdoing or collusion between the campaign and Russia in the communications. The conversations were about improving future economic relations and cooperating in the effort to destroy Islamic terrorism. These are the same subjects that candidate Trump spoke about publicly on the campaign trail. There was no odious conspiracy or secret treachery in the making. It was all rather routine in the evolving political landscape. The Clinton campaign also had contacts with the Russian government. A Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, confirmed that Ambassador Sergei Kislyak met with Clinton advisors because that is part of his job. Well, if you look at some people connected with Hillary Clinton during her campaign, you would probably see that he, Kislyak, had lots of meetings of that kind. There are lots of specialists in politology, people working in think tanks advising Hillary or advising people working for Hillary. But no one in the media made an issue of it. Nor did the FBI investigate the Clintons when Bill traveled to Moscow in June 2010 for a $500,000 speech and a meeting with Vladimir Putin. The reason is simple and obvious. The Clintons and their associates were free to speak with Russians or meet with them, just as anyone in the Trump campaign was entitled to do the same. However, as explained in the last chapter, using a public office to confer a benefit to a foreign government in exchange for money, as Clinton may have done, would be illegal. Yet the FBI decided to criminalize constitutionally protected speech and actions by Trump and his associates by opening an investigation that the Bureau knew would damage the candidate's chances once it was leaked. It might also help to destroy his presidency if elected. No such comparable investigation of Clinton was opened. Thanks to a complicit media, several of the Trump-associated meetings described above gained exaggerated attention with near-hysterical press coverage that implied criminality. But the essential question remained unanswered by the FBI. What legal justification did it have to investigate a presidential nominee when it opened its probe in July 2016, right after it had cleared Clinton in the email case? A close examination of records and reports shows the Bureau had almost no reliable facts or evidence required under the law. Yet Director Comey and his agents pursued Trump and his campaign associates with exceptional zeal in what appeared to be a politically motivated agenda to harm the candidate to the benefit of his opponent. A close examination of the various contacts and conversations with Russians reveals that none of them were consequential or sufficient to launch a criminal investigation. Yet none of this deterred the FBI from secretly assigning a government informant to work undercover in an attempt to elicit any incriminating evidence he could find within the Trump campaign by talking with associates of the candidate. When this tactic was uncovered in May of 2018, Trump accused the FBI of spying on his campaign, whereupon the Justice Department announced an investigation to determine whether there was any impropriety or political motivation involved and to take appropriate action. Papadopoulos's bar talk. George Papadopoulos, a 28-year-old energy consultant, was selected to serve as a volunteer on a Trump campaign foreign policy advisory panel in March 2016. Though he had no real experience on matters related to Russia, he reportedly felt that improved relations with Moscow would be a good idea for the next president. He pushed for a meeting between Trump and Putin, but the campaign rebuffed the idea. The next month, while in London, Papadopoulos met with Joseph Mifsud, a Maltese professor who stated that some Russian officials in Moscow claimed to have dirt on Clinton in the form of emails. There appears to be no known evidence that the young volunteer ever passed this information along to the campaign. However, Papadopoulos made mention of the rumored Clinton emails and supposed Russian contacts to an Australian diplomat, Alexander Downer, at a London bar during a night of what was later described as heavy drinking. Months later, when hacked emails from Democrats were leaked to the public, Downer allegedly contacted the FBI, thinking there might be some possible correlation to what he had heard in the bar. A year and a half later, the New York Times ran a front-page story citing unnamed American and foreign officials, stating that the Australian diplomat's tip to the FBI is what triggered the Bureau's opening of the criminal investigation of Trump-Russia collusion. Perhaps not coincidentally, the story was published at a time when the FBI was under intense pressure to justify why exactly it had commenced an investigation of Trump to begin with. If the probe was opened based on an unverified dossier about Trump that was paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, then the investigation itself was highly suspect. Let's examine the rumor Papadopoulos heard. An unidentified person in Moscow told a professor that he had dirt on an American candidate. The professor told Papadopoulos, who then told an Australian diplomat, who then told the FBI. Forget that the professor denied he ever had such a discussion with Papadopoulos about Russian dirt on Clinton. Anyone along the chain of chatter could have lied or exaggerated or mistakenly conveyed the exchange of words. By the time the alleged information was repeated numerous times and eventually reached the FBI, it was what lawyers call quadruple hearsay. It contained no indicia of reliability and would never be accepted as trustworthy evidence in a court of law. It would be inadmissible in every courtroom in America. Hence, it should never have been used by the FBI as justification for opening a criminal probe of any American citizen, much less a candidate for the presidency. Rumors, innuendo, supposition, and gossip are not a legal basis for criminal investigations. The alleged information must first be verified. Therefore, the Times story made little sense. Papadopoulos was trading grapevine whispers and speculation with no way of knowing whether any of it was true. Nowhere in the article did the reporters raise the essential question of why the Bureau would initiate a criminal probe with such scant and legally insufficient evidence. The New York Times reported that Papadopoulos also traded correspondence with a Russian and once met with another Russian. This is neither illegal nor improper. His apparent goal was to improve relations between the two nations by organizing a summit between Trump and Putin. The campaign, however, was not interested in this overly ambitious and premature idea. Before opening its case, the FBI was required to identify a possible crime. Where was the crime in listening to someone claim that Moscow had dirt on Clinton? Where was the crime in repeating that bit of gossip? Even if someone in the Trump campaign acted on the information in some way, it was still not a crime to do so, as will be explained later in the book. It is more likely that the Papadopoulos conversations were not the impetus for the Trump-Russia collusion case, but something else. At best, they served as a propitious pretext for an illegitimate probe. At worst, they were employed as a contrived cover for a politically motivated inquisition by the FBI, designed to harm Trump in the campaign or the White House if elected. While it was not a crime to speak with Professor Mifsud or pass along his words of conjecture, it was a crime for Papadopoulos not to be forthcoming about it with FBI agents when they approached him in January 2017 for questioning. For reasons that were inexplicable and baffling, he did not tell the truth and was charged with and pled guilty to making a material false statement. He was not charged with collusion or any other crime because there was nothing illegal about his contacts or conversation involving Russians. Had Papadopoulos simply told the truth, he would not have been charged with anything. The Times reporters may have been used, wittingly or unwittingly, to deflect attention from the dubious dossier and to provide some other justification for the Trump investigation. If this was the goal, it was an implausible and clumsy attempt at misdirection. Under no normal circumstances could a rumor based on multiple hearsays be a proper and legal reason for opening a criminal investigation, especially when the original source was not even identified and none of the allegations were sustained. It's worth looking more closely at the dossier and why President Trump's tormentors would rather that we didn't. Chapter 6. The Fabricated Dossier Used Against Trump. Apart from the Constitution, the government ought not to use evidence obtained and only obtainable by a criminal act. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes on the use of wiretaps. Olmstead v. the United States, 1928. 277 United States Supreme Court, 438, pages 469 and 470. Everything the Central Intelligence Agency does is cloaked in stealth and secrecy. Subversion is a proficiency. Duplicity is second nature. Against this hushed backdrop, it is not easy to uncover John Brennan's machinations while he was President Obama's CIA chief. However, a senior aide to the House Intelligence Committee who examined Brennan's actions involving the dossier offered this analysis. John Brennan did more than anyone to promulgate the dirty dossier. He politicized and effectively weaponized what was false intelligence against Trump. What exactly did Brennan do? When he learned of the dossier, he allegedly gave the information contained therein to the FBI and Democrats on Capitol Hill, and certain members of the media were alerted. According to his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, Brennan seemed to acknowledge that he was among the first individuals to have access to the dossier and soon alerted the FBI, which then opened its Trump-Russia investigation. He also began telling top members of Congress of his information indicating that Russia was working to help elect Donald J. Trump president, as reported by the New York Times. Whether he told them his information came from an unproven dossier is unclear, but his access to it would seem to answer that question. Unanswered is whether Brennan ever took any steps to verify the contents of the dossier or affirm its authenticity. As director of the CIA, it was well within his authority to do this, since both the author and the alleged sources were foreign actors who supposedly possessed information about illicit activities in the United States. For example, gathering intelligence on Russia's suspected hacking of America's computer systems would be well within the CIA's purview. If Brennan studied the dossier, he would have inexorably concluded the document was worthless, although that might not have deterred him from using it for political purposes to hurt Trump and help Clinton. On its face, the dossier was a preposterous collection of rumors, innuendos, supposition, and wild speculation. At least one significant part of it contained demonstrably false statements. In its entirety, the set of documents incorporated not a bit of direct evidence. Instead, it was based solely on multiple hearsay accounts from inherently unreliable sources in Russia who were, notably, experts in lies and disinformation. Some sources were apparently paid for passing along the hearsay, which made their claims even more suspect. Although some Russian names were referenced, almost none of the information attributed to them actually came from them. The sources were largely anonymous, But their lack of credibility could be determined by the capacious characterizations of their duties and Kremlin connections. Even more suspect were the financial backers who solicited the injurious material. It was paid for by Democrats and the Clinton campaign. This should have instantly called into question its veracity because of obvious underlying partisan motives. It was a classic example of what's known as opposition research, with the notable exception that it appears to have been entirely contrived. The material was not derived from public documents or voting records as most opposition research originates. Instead, it seemed to have been dreamed up and then propagated by pro-Clinton and anti-Trump forces, notably Brennan among them. The author of the dossier should have been considered inherently untrustworthy, if indeed he was the author at all. As a former British spy, Christopher Steele was trained in deception and chicanery. Reportedly, he never traveled to Russia to gather his so-called intelligence. Rather, he claimed to have had Kremlin-connected sources, even though he had not set foot in Russia since the early 1990s. Given the change in leadership there during the course of more than two decades, it is highly doubtful that any of his so-called sources held important government positions or otherwise had first-hand access to dependable information. Upon reading the contents of the dossier, Brennan must have known that it was no more reliable than a supermarket tabloid. Yet the evidence suggests that he advocated the use of the dubious document to damage Trump. Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian studies at New York University in Princeton, spoke about Brennan's role and what he described as Russiagate on a New York radio show, the contents of which were published in The Nation under Cohen's name. Brennan played a central role in promoting the Russiagate narrative, briefing members of Congress privately and giving President Obama himself a top-secret envelope in early August 2016 that almost certainly contained Steele's dossier. In short, if these reports and Brennan's own testimony are to be believed, he, not the FBI, was the instigator and godfather of Russiagate. Certainly, his subsequent frequent and vociferous public retelling of the Russiagate allegations against Trump suggests that he played a, and probably the, instigating role. And, it seems, a role in the Steele dossier as well. James Kallstrom, who once served as assistant director of the FBI, agreed, offering insight gleaned from his conversations with those who had access to Brennan's maneuvers and manipulations behind the scenes. "My sources tell me Brennan was leaking almost weekly or daily, and he was taking that bunch of phony crap supposedly from Russia and peddling that through the Congress and the media. He was one of the active people. I've known him a long time, and I think he's involved, and quite frankly, I think it goes right to the top." The top, of course, meant President Obama, who received constant foreign policy briefings from his CIA director. Brennan was an Obama and Clinton loyalist at his core. However, in his role as head of the agency that was dedicated to collecting intelligence, Brennan was supposed to be a nonpartisan and apolitical voice. His actions in proliferating the unfounded dossier were plainly political and deeply biased. Author and commentator Paul Sperry interviewed Gene Coyle, a 30-year CIA veteran who served under Brennan. Coyle described Brennan as the greatest sycophant in the history of the CIA and a supporter of Hillary Clinton before the election. He added that Brennan made it very clear that he was a supporter of candidate Clinton, hoping he would be rewarded with being kept on in her administration. In his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee in May 2017, Brennan admitted that information he received about the Trump campaign and Russians served as the basis for the FBI investigation to determine whether such collusion, cooperation, occurred. While Brennan did not specifically refer to the unproven dossier, it is clear that he took credit for instigating the Bureau's investigation of candidate Trump. Journalist Lee Smith, who writes for the Weekly Standard and Tablet, described Brennan's role in the Trump-Russia case. In other words, the FBI investigation didn't start when the Australians, according to the New York Times, or the Brits, according to Brennan's most recent version of the story, contacted the FBI after the Papadopoulos Downer meeting. No, it started when the director of the CIA decided to start an investigation, when Brennan passed on information and intelligence to the FBI and signaled the Bureau better act on it. It is true that James Comey, who cleared Clinton, made the ultimate decision to investigate Trump and his campaign. And FBI agent Peter Sturzok, who loathed Trump, is the one who signed the papers opening the probe. But it appears to have all been orchestrated by Brennan, whose enmity toward Trump he has not tried to conceal in comments and tweets since Election Day 2016. In one message posted more recently, Brennan ranted, "When the full extent of your venality, moral turpitude, and political corruption becomes known, you will take your rightful place as a disgraced demagogue in the dustbin of history." Tired clichés aside, Brennan was anything but apolitical. He was Clinton's advocate and protector. In that role, he politicized phony intelligence and instigated the fraudulent case against Trump. If there is any doubt that Brennan is capable of such malevolence, consider the ominous warning issued by Obama's United Nations ambassador, Samantha Power. Not a good idea to piss off John Brennan. It is reasonable to conclude, therefore, that the Russia collusion hoax began when Brennan seized upon the dossier to wreak havoc on the Trump campaign. Precisely when he would have first perceived it is unclear. However, as explained in the previous chapter, he reportedly met with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid in August 2016. 2 days later, Reid sent the first of two letters to Comey demanding an investigation. Those letters were conveniently made public to sully Trump's candidacy with the taint of scandal in advance of the election. Brennan wasn't the only top official in the intelligence community that was suspected of peddling the fake dossier. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, was also involved, according to information uncovered by the House Intelligence Committee. Representative Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, described Clapper's role. "The guy who leaked information about the dossier is James Clapper." Jordan insists Clapper gave the material to CNN, where he is now a paid contributor. "Specifically leaking information, I believe, from that January 6, 2017 meeting where they briefed President Trump, then President-elect Trump, on the dossier. Someone at CNN got information. We think it was Mr. Clapper who gave it to them." And then a few days later, BuzzFeed prints the entire dossier. Jordan's account is backed up by the summary of findings published by the House Intelligence Committee when it concluded that Clapper was not forthcoming about media leaks. Finding number 44 states, "Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, now a CNN national security analyst, provided inconsistent testimony to the committee about his contacts with the media, including CNN." But how did top intelligence officials in the Obama administration get their hands on the dossier in the first place? Who commissioned it? Where did it come from? The phony dossier. The origins of the anti-Trump dossier began in earnest in April 2016 when Mark Elias, the attorney of record for both the Clinton presidential campaign and the Democratic National Committee, hired a company called Fusion GPS to develop negative information on Trump. Fusion GPS, in turn, hired Christopher Steele, who worked for a private British intelligence firm called Orbis Business Intelligence. Steele had retired as a British agent with MI6 and had once served as a spy stationed in Russia. Elias's firm was paid $12.6 million during the campaign, while Fusion GPS received $1.02 million, and Steele's company Orbis earned $168,000 for his work. The dossier was actually a compendium of 17 consecutive memos believed to be penned by Steele between June and December 2016. The first memo was entitled, "Republican Candidate Donald Trump's Activities in Russia and Compromising Relationships with the Kremlin." It was dated June 20th and alleged that the Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years, but it also accused him of perverted sexual acts that could be used to blackmail him. Armed with this implausible document that identified no specific source, Steele decided to approach the FBI with his unverified claims. Remarkably, Steele met in person with the FBI on July 5th, the very day that Comey cleared Hillary Clinton in her email scandal. Thus, at the moment the FBI was absolving Clinton, it appears that the Bureau was beginning its investigation of Trump into Russian collusion. Perhaps Steele thought that his document in the hands of the FBI and later the media would prevent the Republican candidate from gaining the presidency. This, of course, this would surely ingratiate himself to his financial benefactors. Shortly after the Steele-FBI meeting, the Bureau formally opened its criminal probe of Trump on July 31, 2016, under the pretense of a counterintelligence investigation. In the ensuing months, Steele met with several U.S. news organizations to push his dossier. It is obvious why the Clinton campaign wanted to trash Trump with any dirt, however real or imagined, that it could dig up. The expected Democratic nominee was facing a legitimate challenger for the presidency and was determined to stop him at any cost. $1 million for tabloid garbage may have seemed like a small price to pay given the high stakes of power and the cash machine the Clinton campaign had become. But Steele's motive appears to have been personal. According to evidence produced by the House Intelligence Committee, the ex-spy confided to a Justice Department official that he was desperate that Donald Trump not get elected and was passionate about him not being president. Any intelligent person with an ounce of skepticism would have quickly dismissed the contents of the dossier as nothing more than a collection of unsubstantiated and far-fetched assertions cobbled together by someone with a motive to smear Trump by inventing the equivalent of sordid fairy tales. It read like a horribly written spy novel. This was the challenge for the Clinton campaign and their allies: how to peddle a fantastic set of lies to the FBI and journalists. It took a while. The first obstacle, of course, was the dossier itself. It is worth reading online, if you're looking for a good chuckle. But here are some highlights. Russia had been cultivating Trump as a political asset for many years. Trump and Russia were exchanging intelligence with each other for 8 years. Russia had been supporting his candidacy for at least 5 years. Russia had been feeding Trump valuable intelligence on Clinton for years. Trump was favored by Russia with lucrative real estate deals. Trump's lawyer met secretly in Prague with a Kremlin official. Carter Page met secretly in Moscow with two Russian officials, Sechin and Devakin, promising to lift Russians' sanctions. Page and Paul Manafort were intermediaries in the Trump-Russia conspiracy. Trump agreed to sideline Russian intervention in Ukraine in exchange for hacked email operation. Trump defiled a hotel bed in Moscow where he knew the Obamas had slept. Russia was exploiting Trump's personal obsessions and sexual perversions for blackmail purposes. No evidence was offered, and there was never any proof that it was true. Some of it was conspicuously false. All of it was transparently partisan and patently absurd. Yet this document was used by Fusion GPS and Christopher Steele to convince a willing FBI to open an investigation into Trump and spy on his associates. The Bureau was either duped or, more likely, became a willing participant in its zeal to steer the election in a way that would conform to its own political preference, namely Clinton. Paul Roderick Gregory studied the dossier within days of it becoming public in January 2017. He is considered an expert on Russia and the Soviet Union, having visited there close to 100 times dating back to the 1960s and having written several books. Gregory opined that the author's use of words like trusted compatriots to identify his anonymous sources, plus other telltale signs within the composition, convinced him that the dossier was actually compiled by a Russian determined to invent a collection of lies for the purpose of creating mischief. There are two possible explanations for the fly-on-the-wall claims of the Orbis report. Either its author, who is not Mr. Steele, decided to write fiction, or collected enough gossip to fill a 30-page report, or a combination of the two. The author of the Orbis report has one more advantage. He knew that what he was writing was unverifiable. Gregory singled out one claim that was particularly ludicrous: that Trump's peripheral advisor on the Foreign Policy Council, Carter Page, promised to lift sanctions against Russia in exchange for a 19% stake in the oil company Rosneft, which would amount to a multi-billion dollar bribery scheme to line the pockets of either Page or Trump or both. This story is utter nonsense, not worthy of a wacky conspiracy theory of an alien invasion. The huge bribe for, perhaps, lifting the sanctions makes Nikita Khrushchev's harebrained schemes, for which he was fired, look eminently reasonable. To its credit, Newsweek also turned a critical eye to the dossier and published a story entitled 13 Things That Don't Add Up in the Russia-Trump Intelligence Dossier. Besides picking apart the main allegations, the magazine also took notice of what it described as tortured and borderline non-native syntax and basic ignorance of Russia. All of this called into question not only authorship and sourcing, but the veracity of any of the dossier's bizarre and outlandish claims. In truth, there was little that was intelligent about the so-called intelligence document purportedly authored by Steele and or his company Orbis or a Russian. The only allegation that was subject to verification seemed to be rather easily disproven. The document alleged that Trump's attorney Michael Cohen secretly met with Russians in Prague in August 2016 to arrange cash payments and devise a cover-up operation. It was provably false. Records show that Cohen was in Los Angeles and New York during the stated time frame. There are no known international records of him traveling to Prague that have been publicly produced. In reaction to the accusation, Cohen stated, "I'm telling you emphatically that I've not been to Prague, I've never been to Czech Republic, I've not been to Russia. The story is completely inaccurate. It is fake news meant to malign Mr. Trump." Lawyers are taught and jurors are instructed that if a witness lies about one part of his testimony, it may be concluded that all of his testimony is untrue. And so it was with the dossier, but more so. Viewed either through the lens of its individual assertions or in its entirety, it was preposterous. Even a casual reader of the document would reach this conclusion. And so would a discerning journalist like Bob Woodward, who called it a garbage document. Frankly, that may be an insult to garbage. On an edition of Fox News Sunday, Woodward, the associate editor of the Washington Post, who rose to fame uncovering the Watergate scandal, told host Chris Wallace that American intelligence chiefs made a mistake and should apologize. What did the Russians have to say? Dmitry Peskov, a spokesman for the Kremlin, labeled the unverified memo as pulp fiction. He said, "I can assure you that the allegations in this funny paper, in this so-called report, they are untrue. They are all fake." Russian President Vladimir Putin offered that the dossier was an attempt by the outgoing American President Barack Obama to undermine the legitimacy of the president-elect. Putin's theory is a pretty good bet. Speaking at a news conference shortly after the document was published, Putin branded as nonsense the notion that Russia had been collaborating with Trump for many years. Trump, when he came to Moscow a few years ago, was not a politician. We did not even know about his political ambitions. He was just a businessman, one of the richest men in America. Is someone really thinking that our intelligence agencies are chasing every American billionaire, or what? Of course not. It's just a complete nonsense. Naturally, the comments of Peskov and Putin should be viewed with skepticism, inasmuch as they had the incentive to hide the kind of activity that was alleged in the dossier. However, Putin's mocking dismissal of the charge that the Kremlin had been cultivating Trump as a political asset for many years and exchanging intelligence with him for 8 years was a valid one. If the claim was true, it would suggest uncommon, if not inhuman, prescience on the part of Russian leaders. No crystal ball or set of tea leaves would have envisioned Trump's electoral ascendancy all those years before. But those in the U.S. Intelligence Committee, the FBI, and Democrats who had access to the dossier set aside whatever doubts or misgivings they may have had about the farcical document. Truth be damned, the dossier could be exploited for a malevolent objective. That is, it could be weaponized to influence the election. Should that fail, it could always be repurposed to bring down Trump's presidency. Carter Page and the dossier. Carter Page played a minor role in the Trump campaign, but became a major instrument in the government's quest to pursue the Trump campaign. As an investment banker and a vice president at Merrill Lynch, Page had been assigned by the company to work in Moscow for 3 years. Thereafter, he started his own energy investment firm in New York. At a time when some were questioning the foreign policy bona fides of a businessman turned presidential candidate who had never held public office, the Trump campaign decided it would be prudent to convene a foreign policy advisory council to help deflect the criticism. A board was hastily assembled, and Page, by virtue of his background in Russia and energy, as well as his doctorate degree, was selected as a member upon the recommendation of Sam Clovis, who eventually became co-chair of the Trump campaign. There is no indication the candidate knew Page, and in fact the advisor, if he could even be called that, informed Congress, "I've never spoken with him any time in my life." He stressed that he had never communicated with Trump in any form, including texts or emails. Page was not even in attendance at the one meeting the council had in the presence of Trump. The Policy Council itself appeared to have been a device to add some patina to the nominee's credentials on foreign policy where experience was lacking. To suggest that Page was an incidental participant in the campaign is an overstatement. In his testimony before Congress, he described himself as a junior unpaid advisor. Page made a trip to Moscow to speak at a commencement ceremony for the new economic school. In 2009, President Obama spoke there too, so it may have been the case that the school was simply interested in inviting someone associated, however tangentially, to the upcoming presidential election of 2016. Page alerted the campaign of his speaking engagement and received permission to proceed, although campaign